This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Later this month, the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park is presenting the world premiere of Safe House by playwright Keith Joseph Atkins. It's inspired by Atkins' ancestors, and Safe House is set in northern Kentucky in 1843, almost 20 years before the start of the Civil War. And it tells the journey of a free family of color and of two brothers who have conflicting dreams about how to secure their futures. Keith Joseph Atkins and Playhouse Associate Artist Timothy Douglas, who's directing the production of Safe House, join us to talk about the themes raised in this play. And thanks for joining me this afternoon. Much appreciated.
Nice to be here.
Thank you.
You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Keith, you have to tell me about the family that inspired Safe House, the Pettigrew family, and the two brothers, Shoemaker and Frank, correct?
Right, yeah, okay. Addison and Frank. They're both okay. Shoemakers, more or less.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, excuse me. I read that incorrectly. It's bad eyesight.
No.
Addison and Frank.
Right.
And they speaking of bad eyesight, they just can't seem to see eye to eye, can they?
No, they can't. Most brothers can't.
Okay.
The play was inspired by, my grandmother's, family. Her family, I should say, has been living in the Cincinnati area since the 1780s.
Wow.
They came here after the American Revolution as free people of color, and they, settled in, Bourbon County, Kentucky, Brown County, Ohio, and just sort of back and forth across the river as free people. Many of them worked as artisans. And in this particular family that I focused on, at least what inspired the play, was a family that lived in Harrison County, Kentucky, and they were a family of shoemakers, the father and all four of his sons. And what I found fascinating was that I had no idea this was part of my legacy.
Wow. So this is a discovery for you as well.
Yes, definitely. My grandmother, talked about the accomplishments of her family, and she talked about how her grandmother was born in Wilmington, Ohio, and just sort of casual conversations about cousins and how much she loved Kentucky and how beautiful Kentucky was. But she never talked about any historical information. And once I asked her if, I think I was like a school assignment in junior high or high school, and it was like about slavery, and I asked about if her grandparents had been slaves, and she said, no, we were never slaves. And she said it so casually. I think she just kind of walked in the room and finished baking something. And I thought, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Like, because all black people were slaves, from my understanding and my teaching.
Likewise.
And so when I got interested in genealogy and started to crack open her family's history, I discovered she was indeed accurate that, in tracking her family back all the way to the 1720s, they were free people of color. So I just knew that had to be staged or told, you know.
Did you do your research through, did you get most of it through oral history, or were you able to find any photos or documents, about your family?
I had photos, but I had no idea, the context of the photos. But most of the research I did was through the Mormon Genealogical Library, and also Ancestry.com. Those like census records, and also the Daughters of the American Revolution, interestingly, had copies of marriage certificates in my grandmother's family. And when I discovered that, I was like, wait a minute, this is a little deeper than I thought.
Wow.
I found a yeah, marriage certificate from 1818 in Bourbon County, Kentucky, of a man and a woman who were both black, both free, and documented at the courthouse.
Now, how unusual was it for free people of color to be living in Kentucky instead of crossing the river and going north?
That's a good question. I assume because they came over in the 1780s, and Kentucky at that point was still very much frontier. And a lot of them most likely got land grants for fighting for on the American side of the revolution, or just the fact that Virginia was offering people, opportunities to just help, settle the frontier of Kentucky. And I didn't think it mattered at that time who was free and who wasn't free, as long as they were going to help chop down some of this wood. And so I think because they traveled in groups, they were able to sustain their status, sustain a certain sense of safety. It wasn't until later, maybe 20 or 30 years later, when laws became much more intense for free people of color, and certainly for enslaved blacks. So I think they probably just settled here, and this was home. There was no reason to go across the river yet.
Tim, how do you feel about directing Safe House? Has this been different from a lot of the other plays that you've directed in the past?
It has, and I really relied on Keith's oral history to help me understand the specificities of dramaturgy and how much research I needed to do on my own. And uncharacteristically, the more I tried to venture out on my own, it just got confusing. I think partly because in terms of how I receive it, and even this conversation, I'm learning even more, Keith. Thank you so much.
The
inspiration for the play Safe House is so personal and so directly connected to the playwright that I, in the tradition of oral history, I continue to receive it and then I interpret. And it's so pure, the experience of receiving from Keith and then interpreting through and for the actors. It's a very a right brain activity, much more than what I'm used to. So it's been great. But I feel like I'm not ahead of the pack at all. I'm really walking with the play and with the story as we're putting it together.
Fascinating. Oh, wow. Is it safe to say, both of you, that this is a little-known chapter in our region's history?
Certainly. I think national history.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize there were huge free people of color communities. And often I think people, when they think of free blacks, they think of black people who have been emancipated or manumitted by their owners, you know, throughout the 18th or 19th century. But the larger free people of color population were descendants of white indentured women who had children by men of color. And most of the time, those children were born in so-called marriages, but those marriages weren't often identified as legal. But despite that, the children, because their mothers were white, despite her class, were considered free because the mom was considered, white women were considered free despite their class. And so you have these children born of white women who are then themselves free. And they most often married other free people of color from similar circumstances. And so it just grew and grew and grew. And so these communities start traveling together, marrying into each other. Virginia, North Carolina had massive free people of color communities. And even when Andrew Jackson kicked out the Native American population of the Southeast, a lot of the free people of color communities were also kicked out, because they just threatened the economic, stability of some communities. They threatened jobs for whites. And so they just sort of kind of went where there were opportunities for them to thrive, you know?
So even though they were free, they were not getting better treatment. They faced a lot of hardships.
Oh, certainly. Oh, certainly. Yeah. Because jobs were scarce. They had to find some kind of trade that was going to be beneficial to the larger white community. A lot of communities that were white, in Kentucky, even in Ohio and Indiana, were not welcoming of the free people. So, they had to find the right place to be. And often that was difficult. A lot of them, it's interesting because even, there's part of my family that were free. However, they didn't show up in the census records because they were so poor and they were working for white families. So they never even were, you know, registered as free people, because they couldn't find work outside of white establishments. So.
Tim, can you talk about some of the people who are in the cast and some of the people who are doing the creative work for the play?
Absolutely. In the role of the brothers, Addison and Frank are Leroy McLean and Shane Taylor, respectively. These are two very powerful actors, and to watch them in the rehearsal room, you would never know that they were not actual brothers. In just the simpatico between, and then in the acting of the story, how fully they can go to the place that is violent, that can happen, that can just spark with conflicts between brothers who are passionate and have separate visions. Stephanie Berry, in the role of Dorcas, their aunt, the matriarch of that family, who took over the raising of these two boys after both their parents died. In the role of Bracken, it's hard to describe him. I describe him as the sheriff's minion. He's white, and he is responsible for the policing of this family for very specific reasons. I don't know how much we want to give away of the plot. In the role of Bracken is Wilbur Henry. If you've seen Clybourne Park, you remember him from that production. I guess we would describe the role of Clarissa as a love interest, and that's played by Diana Bouye, who was also in Clybourne Park at the Playhouse last season. And rounding out the cast is a character named Roxy. She is a runaway slave. And in that role is Shannon Dorsey, who was seen in Trip to Bountiful at the Playhouse. Tony Chiswick designing the sets. Cara Harmon has designed costumes. And Michael Gilliam is our a lighting designer, and Vinnie Oliveri, our sound designer and composer.
Tim, I'm impressed. You did that without looking any notes. Very impressive run through.
He's brilliant.
He is. That's why he has this job,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
We're talking with Keith Joseph Atkins and Timothy Douglas about the new play Safe House, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we're talking about the two brothers, Addison and Frank. Keith, was part of your inspiration for Safe House a fascination with the favoritism and the rivalry that goes on within families, that dynamic tension inside a family? And you saw some of this in your own family, as a matter of fact.
Well, definitely. I think we all see sibling rivalry happen.
Rivalry can be fascinating, can it?
Yes, it makes for good drama.
And ends up being the anchor for the journey of this play within this history that is so unknown to so many people. Mm-hmm. So that actually is the anchor.
No. It's true. I mean, there was nothing personal that I pulled from my own family's dynamics, but I did think it was, in order to sort of have a realistic experience in writing the play, I had to decide on something that I think we all sort of share, which is conflict in family. I think we all have seen that and see it constantly. And I know my grandfather, my mom's dad, and his brother, his brother's name was Shakespeare, by the way, Shakespeare Jr. So my grandfather was often upset that he wasn't named Shakespeare. So they feuded about that. They feuded about, you know, whose car was the fanciest. My brothers, of course, you know, they were 14 months apart, so I was always witness to them fighting over girls, fighting over the phone, fighting over jobs. And so I thought it would be interesting to sort of find something for Frank and Addison in the story to fight over, and that would be dreams. And I feel like then, in the 19th century, you know, the luxuries of, you know, cars and girlfriends, you know, that's a very common modern thing. But in the 19th century, I think things people fought over were much more urgent, much more about survival, much more about identity and how identity is attached to survival. And so Frank and Addison certainly have a lot of things that they want in the world for themselves. They have a lot of limitations based on the fact that they are free people of color, and they're sort of quarantined and cornered in a certain part of the county that they live in. And so everything matters to them, like everything. So,
Tim, with a play like this where you have some intense issues being explored, do the actors get so immersed in the roles that they sometimes are a little uncomfortable with it, and they might have to take a step back after a scene and take a breath? Have you seen that?
In the dynamic of exploring the play, no, it's not a level of discomfort. As Black people raised in America, and being artists as well, we've all experienced the depths of growing pains, dealing with creativity, dealing with discourse within a family, and being the gifted actors that they are, they are very facile with going to those places, and the writing is so clear, we have a great map. After, certainly, then this group of actors, specifically the coming together to sort of the mini healings that take place after the big conflicting scenes, they do that organically as well. And I think it's more of who they are as people and as artists that has created that generosity of spirit. It makes my job a lot easier.
As a director, you have to love having actors and
who take care of, you know, they take care of themselves. And
yeah.
So, and I'm pretty sensitive. I know when it's time to let it be before we move on. And, it continues to be a remarkable journey.
Has Safe House played in any other cities yet, Keith?
No, this is a world premiere production.
This is the world premiere for it.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I've had readings. I was even here in Cincinnati about 5 or 6 years ago. I had a residency at Taft Museum, the Duncan residency. And part of that 2-week residency, it was a day where they actually did a reading of the play at, Ensemble Theater of Cincinnati. So that was the first, I think, exposure that the play had in front of an audience. But it's had readings and.
What was the reaction like at that?
It was quite positive. Most of the people in the audience were my family members. but it was, I think, you know, there's a certain moment in the play, and I'm not going to tell you what moment it is, but I realized that I had hit a chord when the audience gasps. There was a certain moment in the play where everyone gasps, and I'm like, wow, like this works. I've done something interesting here. And it was here in Cincinnati where that happened. And I was like, oh, okay, this, I think I got something here. I got something. So
is it safe to say that Safe House is not really so much a story about slavery as it is? It's more about the family and their journey, isn't it?
Well, definitely. Yeah. It's not about slavery directly, because it's about a free family of color, who, as far as they know, they don't know anyone in the story, in their family history that was ever slave. So, they are experiencing an experience that is different from the enslaved community around them, which is a hard thing to navigate, because you want to, one, live out your freedom. Two, you also want to help others. And I often feel, at least in my exploration of this play, the characters, are torn between what is best for their own individual freedoms and how do they also open their arms and help the community around them who are not free. And I think actually that's kind of the big conflict in the play. Do we serve ourselves and continue to move forward, or do we kind of stay static and help others, you know?
So. And my feeling, though, Keith's play is not about slavery per se, because we are in Kentucky in the 1840s, slavery is very much present in the room. And I think that's very much going to be true for the audiences that attend. And I find myself directing Safe House as a counterpoint to the presence of African-American slavery.
Hmm. Now, on October the 20th, there's an event going on where the Playhouse is partnering with the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. Yeah. Can you tell us some more about that event that's coming up and what's going to happen at that?
The structure of it is still forming, and I know that the impetus of the panel was to focus on economic impact, specifically having to do with African Americans in this region, legacy of our history leading up to that. But like this play, the things that are most compelling end up always surprising me. And so in that sense, it's still finding what it wants to be. But I can tell you two of the confirmed panelists are Clifford Bailey and Sean Ruggles. I'm sorry. I can't see it on the paper because I'm not wearing my glasses, but of the African American Chamber, or at least Chamber of Commerce.
I can't see with my glasses, too. I'm sorry.
And of course, Keith and I think there may be some others, but it's going to be a fascinating discussion. Right. And I imagine the audience is going to be involved as well.
Right. Yes. And are we also going to do an excerpt from the play?
Yes, we'll do a scene from the play as well.
Yeah.
And there's also a partnership with the Public Library of Cincinnati, isn't there, where you can get a behind the scenes look at some of the aspects of Safe House?
I did not know that. I look forward to it.
I don't know much about it, so I can't be the perfect salesman for it. But I did read and hear that I think they're actually there's some installments, maybe 19th century Kentucky slavery, free people of color kind of exhibits. I did hear that.
Let's go right after this.
I think we should go check it out. I want to know for sure.
Well, it sounds interesting because like we've been saying, this is a part of history that I really didn't know much about. I had never heard that expression before, free people of color.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's fascinating to me. Are there a lot of historical elements that are woven into this play?
Not necessarily. I mean, what do you think, Timothy?
No, but it's certainly the play leads to very specific questions about this history that, you know, I, as an audience member, I want to go research as soon as I leave the play.
Yeah.
So it really creates a path right to the the history.
Right. Wait, Governor Letcher, who was the governor of Kentucky in the early 1840s, has a presence in the play. He's not a character at all, but certainly a significant presence that helps sort of move the story forward and shape characters' decisions. But I chose 1843 because it was a period in our history where there wasn't a lot of large events happening. There was just sort of life happening. I knew around that time, however, the state of Kentucky prohibited free people of color from reading. Prior to that, I guess there was literacy happening, but I think it was getting sort of out of control, meaning that there was a gain in economic momentum because of the literary resourcefulness of a lot of the free people of color. And that's always a challenge. And I think it's a challenge. I think economically, when you have two different types of people fighting over the same economic resources, it's always an issue. The Irish and the German fought over the same resources in New York City. In this case, you have free people of color and the white community fighting over economic resources and jobs. And often you found that a lot of the free people of color had better jobs than some of the so-called working class white community members. Better jobs mean more skilled trade, artisans, shoemakers, barbers. I had family members who were barbers in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. It's an interesting.
Well, Tim and I have both said that we want to go out and learn more about this aspect of history. And you've talked about how learning about free people of color was a surprise, and you're hoping, I guess, that more people who hear this story think, I want to go out and learn more about this too.
Yeah, definitely. You know, what's interesting is that Southern Ohio in particular and Northern Kentucky, I feel like we're all kind of related to each other culturally and even genetically, right? And so, you know, what's interesting is like my grandmother's family were living in this area, like I said, from the 1780s and sort of back and forth across the river all the way up until like the 1920s. And I think after the 1920s, there was another migration of blacks from the Deep South who kind of, in a way, kind of trumped the earlier black experience in the city and in this area. So I think often that free people of color experience was sort of forgotten because there was another population here who was bringing their own sort of conversations around their Deep South experiences. But what's interesting is that I have several cousins in the city related to my grandmother's family, and many of them didn't know that we were from free people of color. All they knew is that we were property owners. They had heard somebody was, you know, a barber, you know, that kind of thing, but they never was given the proper sort of structure around why that was so, you know?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Including you.
Including me. Yeah. It was interesting. Several years ago, I think Northern Kentucky had either a bicentennial celebration or something like that, bicentennial celebration. And they were mentioning sort of pioneers of early Northern Kentucky, and they mentioned the Southgate family and the black Southgate family, and that's part of my grandmother's family. Wow. And I remember saying to my grandmother, like, hey, that's some of your people. She's like, yeah, that's us. I'm like, we're pioneers?
Gentlemen, unfortunately, we have to run along here. I really appreciate you joining me this afternoon. Fascinating. Wish you the best of luck with this.
Thank you.
Keith Joseph Atkins is the writer of Safe House, and Playhouse associate artist Timothy Douglas, who's directing this production of Safe House, joined me this afternoon. It's going to be presented at the Playhouse's Robert S. Marks Theater, October 18th through November 15th.